is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Obama delivers his final State of the Union address. In his final address to a joint session of the U.S. Congress and the American people, President Obama spoke of his domestic and foreign policy accomplishments and focused on his vision for the country's future. He said his first priority was protecting the American people and going after terrorist networks.
Both Al-Qaeda and now ISIL pose a direct threat to our people because in today's world, even a handful of terrorists who place no value on human life, including their own, can do a lot of damage.
Mr. Obama lauded U.S. participation in stopping the spread of Ebola in West Africa, forging a massive Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade agreement, restarting diplomatic relations with Cuba, and sealing the Iran nuclear deal. U.S. defense sources say the crews of two small U.S. Navy vessels being held by Iran will be released Wednesday morning. The 10 crew members have been traveling in the Persian Gulf between Kuwait and Bahrain. Former U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey says it's important to know the track of both vessels, which involves the internationally recognized right of innocent passage.
Just because a foreign military vessel enters your waters doesn't mean that you can seize that vessel and the personnel.
The Iranian Fars News Agency said the crew members had been arrested for being inside Iranian waters. Ghanaian President John Mahama Wednesday defended his decision to accept two Yemenis released from the U.S. military detention center in Guantanamo, Cuba, after a decade of incarceration, insisting they pose no security threat and will be monitored. Mr. Mahama said he acted on the request by the U.S. government to accept Mahmoud Umar Mohammed bin Atef and Khalid Mohammed Saleh al-Dubi. A coalition of Christian clergy, along with opposition leaders, opposed the transfer, warning it could endanger national security. This is VOA News. The UN resident and humanitarian coordinator for Syria Tuesday described what he called the horrible and terrible situation in the besieged Syrian town of Madaya. Yaqub Hillo spoke to reporters by telephone at UN headquarters from Damascus.
We saw a people that are desperate, a people that are cold, a people that are hungry, a people that have almost lost hope that the world cares about their plight, and a people that are demanding, and this is a message I'm conveying on their behalf, they are demanding that the international community does all it can to lift siege.
Aid workers who got inside Madaya Monday saw what they called the worst sights in the nearly five-year conflict, including people literally starving to death in the streets. Syrian rebels control Madaya, while Syrian government forces surround the city, making escape impossible. Meanwhile, the UN says 400,000 Syrians live in areas besieged by the government, rebels, or armed groups. Millions more live in areas classified as hard to reach for aid workers. Meanwhile, UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, plans to meet ambassadors from the five permanent members of the UN Security Council in Geneva Wednesday. They'll likely talk about the international peace agreement for Syria set for January 25th. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi vowed Tuesday to press forward with the fight against Islamic State extremists as he toured the wreckage of a Baghdad shopping mall hit by suicide bombers a day earlier. He described Monday's attack, which killed at least two dozen people, as a desperate attempt by IS fighters driven from the western city of Ramadi by Iraqi forces. A separate attack Monday claimed by the IS group killed another 23. In apparent retaliation, authorities say as many as seven Sunni mosques and dozens of shops in Iraq's east were firebombed. Abundant crude oil and weakening energy demand from China's huge economy helped push global trade prices, crude prices, down Tuesday to the lowest level in a dozen years. Prices fell briefly below $30 a barrel, a drastic fall from the exceeding $100 a barrel at the peak of June 2014. Carl Larry with the consultancy Frost & Sullivan says the current price may represent a bottoming out of the long slide in prices.
We have seen strong demand for crude oil in the U.S. The runs here that we've seen going to refineries have hit a record 16.1 million barrels a day last year. But the rest of the world remains in a really deep oil glut, and that might keep pressure on prices here, at least in the near term.
In a report published Tuesday, government experts said U.S. crude oil production will fall almost 700,000 barrels a day this year, the first annual decline since 2008. Low prices expected to slow growth in natural gas production. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 13th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. President Barack Obama has delivered his final State of the Union address.
American leadership in the 21st century is not a choice between ignoring the rest of the world, except when we kill terrorists, or occupying and rebuilding whatever society is unraveling. Leadership means a wise application of military power.
An analyst says the U.S. could do more in the fight against Boko Haram in West Africa. Ebola workers in Liberia seek hazard benefits, and there are conflicting casualty figures as Ethiopian authorities crack down on Oromia region protesters.
The highest profile individual who's been arrested that is, you know, cause for concern is Bekele Gerba, one of the leaders of the Oromo Federalist Congress. And Bekele has been an advocate for nonviolent approaches.
Philip Horn is an Ethiopia and Eritrea researcher for Human Rights Watch. Blind Kenyan students learn through technology, and Western standards are inadequate to treat liver cancer in developing countries. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Barack Obama has delivered his seventh and final State of the Union address Tuesday night to the American people, touting his accomplishments as president, focusing on his vision for the country's future, and discussing the need to heal its deep political divides. Speaking to a packed House of Representatives chamber in the U.S. Capitol, Mr. Obama rejected American unilateralism. Instead, he said the U.S. will continue to work with other countries to deal with complex global issues.
Our foreign policy has to be focused on the threat from ISIL and al-Qaeda. But it can't stop there. For even without ISIL, even without al-Qaeda, instability will continue for decades in many parts of the world. In the Middle East, in Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan, in parts of Central America and Africa and Asia. Some of these places may become safe havens for new terrorist networks. Others will just fall victim to ethnic conflict or famine, feeding the next wave of refugees. The world will look to us to help solve these problems. And our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That may work as a TV soundbite, but it doesn't pass muster on the world stage. We also can't try to take over and rebuild every country that falls into crisis, even if it's done with the best of intentions. That's not leadership. That's a recipe for quagmire, spilling American blood and treasure that ultimately will weaken us. It's the lesson of Vietnam. It's the lesson of Iraq, and we should have learned it by now. Fortunately, there is a smarter approach, a patient and disciplined strategy that uses every element of our national power. It says America will always act, alone if necessary, to protect our people and our allies. But on issues of global concern, we will mobilize the world to work with us and make sure other countries pull their own weight. That's our approach to conflicts like Syria, where we're partnering with local forces and leading international efforts to help that broken society pursue a lasting peace. That's why we built a global coalition with sanctions and principled diplomacy to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. And as we speak, Iran has rolled back its nuclear program, shipped out its uranium stockpile, and the world has avoided another war. That's how we stopped the spread of Ebola in West Africa. Our military, our doctors, our development workers, they were heroic. They set up the platform that then allowed other countries to join in behind us and stamp out that epidemic. Hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple million lives were saved.
Mr. Obama also said the strength of American leadership is the wise application of military power and bringing the whole world together behind causes that are right.
American leadership in the 21st century is not a choice between ignoring the rest of the world, except when we kill terrorists, or occupying and rebuilding whatever society is unraveling. Leadership means a wise application of military power and rallying the world behind causes that are right. It means seeing our foreign assistance as a part of our national security, not something separate, not charity. When we lead nearly 200 nations to the most ambitious agreement in history to fight climate change, yes, that helps vulnerable countries, but it also protects our kids. When we help Ukraine defend its democracy, or Colombia resolve a decades-long war, that strengthens the international order we depend on. When we help African countries feed their people and care for the sick, it's the right thing to do, and it prevents the next pandemic from reaching our shores. You know, right now we're on track to end the scourge of HIV/AIDS. That's within our grasp, and we have the chance to accomplish the same thing with malaria, something I'll be pushing this Congress to fund this year.
U.S. President Barack Obama delivering his State of the Union address. An analyst says more attention should be given to the fight against Boko Haram, particularly at the terrorist group's center of operation in northern Nigeria. Bronwyn Brewton, deputy director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, says military campaign alone may not be enough to defeat Boko Haram. Instead, she said the campaign to defeat Boko Haram must try to win the hearts and minds of northern Nigerian citizens.
Unfortunately, I think the U.S. has been able to do less than it would have liked in Nigeria because of difficulties with Goodluck Jonathan's regime over the past several years, concerns about human rights violations by the Nigerian forces and disagreements with the Nigerian military about the kind of assistance that the U.S. should be offering. But the situation is improving. I think that the U.S. is attempting to help with tactical and logistical support. Unfortunately, I think that the fight against Boko Haram has reached a very, very difficult stage where the group has transitioned into guerrilla tactics. And I fear that correcting this is going to really require enormous efforts on the part of Muhammadu Buhari, the new president.
You believe the U.S. could do more than it is doing. Last year, I think the Obama administration sent, about 300 troops along with surveillance drones to Cameroon. They said then to bolster the West African forces. They're also giving, I think they gave about $45 million last year to the countries that are fighting Boko Haram. Do you believe this is enough?
No, I don't think it's enough. You know, $45 million is a drop in the well. It's such a small amount of money when you're talking about the war on terrorism. Not that it's a fair comparison, but at the height of the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. was spending about $350 million a day. And even in Somalia, I think that the U.S., you know, it gives hundreds of millions of dollars a year to fight al-Shabaab. And I think that you can make the case that Boko Haram is probably as great a threat to U.S. interests as al-Shabaab is. There needs to be more attention to dealing with Boko Haram at its heart in northern Nigeria. And I think primarily what needs to be done is that there has to be a campaign to win the hearts and minds of northern Nigerian citizens.
On al-Shabaab, I think the U.S. recently, I think I may have read, where they are going after the supporters of al-Shabaab here by arresting people who may have some connection. I think Somalia may be having elections pretty soon, a very important election. Yet you have al-Shabaab that continues to bomb hotels and everything, probably contributing more to destabilizing a country that wants to get back on track.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in Somalia, you know, like the situation in Nigeria, is unfortunately, it's just intractable. The progress that's been made, and there has been some progress, has been really slow. And there are important milestones that are coming up, like the elections that you mentioned. But unfortunately, I feel that those elections are bound to disappoint. As you've said, is really not possible to hold a poll, a national poll, in a country that is constantly beset by suicide bombings and attacks.
Bronwyn Bruton is the Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Today's Wednesday, January 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. It's part of protest throughout the Oromia region of Ethiopia are now over 8 weeks old and appear to be intensifying. Reports from opposition members and activists claim government forces have killed over 140 protesters as of this week. By contrast, government officials put the total number of deaths at 5. Felix Horn, an Ethiopia and Eritrea researcher for Human Rights Watch, says it is difficult to verify these numbers.
Well, it's very difficult to verify the numbers given all of the restrictions on access to information and doing this research in Ethiopia. I mean, as you know, there's very little in the way of independent media. There's very little in the way of independent civil society that's able to actually be on the ground and corroborate some of the stories that were being heard. So the number that we've been hearing from activists is around 140. This is largely collated from social media videos and photographs. And while certainly any one of those photographs or videos is not evidence of a specific incident happening, when you put it all together, it's very illustrative of a pattern of excessive force being used.
And also arbitrary arrests of opposition leaders and journalists we're witnessing the government cracking down not just on protesters, but also on civil society. Can you walk us through names of the people that you are aware of so far, prominent leaders who were arrested?
Well, the highest profile individual who's been arrested that is, you know, cause for concern is Bekele Gerba, you know, one of the leaders of the Oromo Federalist Congress. And Bekele has been an advocate for nonviolent approaches and has been a very sort of moderate voice in, you know, what has increasingly becoming a very polarized political landscape. So for somebody who's continuously advocating for nonviolence to be arrested and be accused of provoking these protests, I mean, is a very worrying sign. And it's a clear indication that government, you know, was just trying to quell these protests through force rather than sitting down and talking to rural communities about their very legitimate concerns.
I mean, if you think about the opposition leaders inside the country, why do you think that the government is arresting them now, despite the fact that they've been outspoken, speaking to international media, working on the ground, advocating for their rights for quite a while? Why do you think now the government is taking these drastic measures?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think a lot of us worried about the safety of Bekele as these protests unfolded. But a lot of us thought that the government wouldn't take action until after things had quieted down, because arresting him could just inflame the protests even more. So it is quite surprising that he was arrested. We're certainly seeing that other politicians are being arrested, academics, musicians, you know, individuals that have the potential to influence Oromo individuals. It just seems that it's governments reacting out of fear and just trying to stamp down on any sort of dissent or any individuals who are not towing the party line about events in Oromia.
Felix Horn is an Ethiopia and Eritrea researcher for Human Rights Watch. He was speaking with Salem Fikadu of VOA's Amharic service. This week, Liberia could be declared Ebola-free for the third time. But as some Liberians prepare to celebrate what they hope is finally the end of the outbreak, many of the men and women who risk their lives to stop the deadly virus are demanding the Liberian government pay benefits they say were promised them. Prince Collins has more from the Disco Hill Safe Burial Site on the outskirts of Monrovia.
Dozens of angry burial workers have been demonstrating since last week at the Disco Hill Safe Burial Site. They yell out in protest, holding signs that read, "We need our rigs benefits." Some of them are former Ebola burial team workers who were employed during the outbreak. Others were hired after the virus ended to continue on safe burials as a precaution. They are accusing the government of failing to give them 1,500 in promised hazard pay. Tumete Kai, who has been helping to bury the dead since December 2014, says it is only fair that the burial workers be compensated for the risks they took. He recalled his first shift with the Safe and Dignified Burial Team.
And that net, we used car leg, just imagine to bury. And they brought more than 10 dead bodies that very night. and we were using car light just to carry on a safe bearing. And the people, they came up ready, they're not treating us well. We've been doing well. And as I speak to you right now, we are buried more than 3,000 dead bodies.
Mike Slewian, a 38-year-old father of six, was also on the front line burying Ebola victims. He stayed away from his wife and children for 6 months during the height of the outbreak to keep them safe and avoid stigma.
Even now, our community people evolve because we are still associating with Ebola. Are we not Liberians? We are permanent Liberians. We deserve whatsoever benefit they are having. We have children. We have features. You understand? So we can't be taking a risk. People be stepping on our right. We need our benefit.
Many women were part of the teams. They would disinfect the burial workers and the equipment at the end of each day, as well as clean the burial sites. Felicia Colley, a 38-year-old mother of three, is a grave site cleaner.
All the stuff they use, we clean it up and we throw it away. That's our own way, but it is risky. Between the graves, grass growing, even when the body is decaying, you smell the scent. And there are a lot of Ebola body. So it is a risk that we are taking, and we need our money.
In reaction to the former Ebola workers' claims, Liberia's Minister of Health and Social Welfare, Bernice Dine, said the government has paid $23.2 million to all former Ebola workers and does not owe them any money.
The ministry will no longer tolerate any form of street protest and want those involved to peacefully pursue whatever claim they may have.
More than 10,000 Liberians contracted Ebola since the outbreak began in 2014, and more than 4,000 died. If no new cases are found, the World Health Organization will again declare the country free of the deadly virus on January 14. Prince Collins for VOA News, Mike Gibby.
Experts are calling for more targeted standards in developing countries to help diagnose and treat risk factors in liver cancer. It is currently the second most deadly form of cancer worldwide. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Liver cancer accounts for some 750,000 deaths a year globally. Experts say only pancreatic cancer accounts for more deaths. In Western countries, liver cancer typically strikes middle-aged men over 60 who drink alcohol and smoke cigarettes. But the patient profile is a bit different in developing countries, including sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and China. There, it's not uncommon to see liver cancer in young people.
It could be 4 or 5 decades earlier. So, in fact, you are losing your entire life when you are in such major trouble.
Pascal Pinault, a cancer geneticist at Pasteur Institute in Paris, says more than 86% of liver cancer deaths occur in the developing world. But standards to diagnose and treat the disease follow guidelines based on the older Western patients. The guidelines help doctors determine the best course of treatment. Pinault was part of a team of French and Peruvian researchers who conducted a study in the Latin American country involving 250 liver cancer patients who underwent surgery. Their average age was 36, and relatively few had cirrhosis or hardening of liver tissue, which is common in Western liver cancer patients. Under the treatment guidelines, Pinault says those patients might have been written off as incurable, despite their young age and the lack of cirrhosis. They would not have been given potentially life-extending treatment, including surgery, for the lethal disease. Pinault says most patients in developing countries get the most common form of liver cancer after being infected with hepatitis B for a long period of time.
You are living in sub-Saharan Africa, you are infected by hepatitis B virus, but you are also eating food contaminated with a toxin from a microscopic fungi, and then you will develop the liver cancer.
He says many liver cancers worldwide could be avoided through hepatitis B vaccination, but there's a hitch. The vaccine endorsed by the World Health Organization is a series of 4 injections that Pinault says is not easy to get for many people living in remote areas.
I suspect that in some occasion, the vaccination is not done. The immunization is not done.
In addition to increasing the number of people who get vaccinated against hepatitis B, writing in the journal Hellion, Pinot and colleagues call for changing the treatment guidelines to help young liver cancer patients who for now might be considered incurable. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with volleyball. Egypt earned their ticket to the men's volleyball contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics when they won the Africa qualifiers in Brazzaville, Republic of Congo on Tuesday. In a pulsating final, Egypt edged Tunisia with scores of 25-19, 20-25, 25-18, 19-25, and 16-14. Earlier on, Algeria edged Cameroon by 3-2 to clinch third spot. Tunisia, who took part in the 2012 London Olympics, along with Algeria, get a second chance to qualify for Rio de Janeiro at the World Olympic qualifiers in May and June. In athletics, world half-marathon champion Gladys Cherono will not defend her title at the event to be staged in Cardiff, Wales, in Britain on the 26th of March, she told the Nairobi media on Tuesday. Instead, Cherono plans to put her best foot forward at the London Marathon on this 14th of April with the aim of being selected for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. In football, disgraced world football leaders Sepp Blatter and Michel Platini face the prospect of their 8-year ban from all football activities being extended, the FIFA Ethics Committee spokesperson Andreas Bantel disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland on Tuesday. The pair were banned after being found to have breached the FIFA Code of Ethics when, as FIFA President, Blatter paid the then FIFA Vice President Platini over $2 million with no formal contract in 2008. 11. Blatter and Platini seek to appeal against the ban. On a happier note, Rwanda's Sports and Culture Minister Julien Waku tasks the Rwanda national team, the Amavubi, to focus on progressing to the African Nations Championship final, Waku told the media in the capital Kigali on Tuesday. Rwanda is hosting the 3-week contest featuring 16 nations starting on Saturday. Finally, Uganda hosts Cameroon in an African Nations Championship warm-up match in Njeru, some 80 kilometers east of the capital, Kampala, today, Wednesday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A new study says more than half of the children in war-ravaged South Sudan are currently not in school, the highest proportion of any country in the world. The United Nations Children's Fund said Tuesday that 51% of kids between the ages of 6 and 15 in South Sudan are not being educated. The country has endured more than 2 years of civil war that has killed tens of thousands and displaced more than 2 million people from their homes. That is it for this Wednesday, January 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news.